Coming up on the KOC show, contender power rankings in the Eastern Conference with John Fanta from NBC Sports. And we go deep into everything from Anthony Edwards continuing to ascend, the latest around the NBA draft, and of course, Sacramento signed their tank commander, Killian Hayes. We get all that coming up next with John Fanta. And I want to quickly mention on Wednesday, we have a special third episode this week. I have an interview with somebody. I'm not going to spoil who it is, but I'm very, very excited about it to drop on Wednesday. So be sure to tune into that third episode this week, aside from our normal Monday, Thursday scheduling this week on Wednesday. All right, but right now we got John Fanta. All right, now joining me from NBC Sports, John Fanta. John, how are you?
Kevin, it is terrific to be with you. I'm doing great. It's always fun to see you and be talking basketball this time of year because, of course, we're getting into a really fun year in the NBA, and March is just about to arrive, my friend, so we're into it here. A lot of fun hoop to come.
Your favorite time of the year coming up with March Madness, and you have a big day tomorrow on Tuesday. You're broadcasting the Blazers-Wolves game for NBA on NBC. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but we're going to start out with the Eastern Conference because it feels like right now the Eastern Conference, there's a tier developing at the top with four teams that it seems like there's a real chance. These are the teams that could represent the Eastern Conference in the NBA Finals. So we're going to rank the top four contenders in the Eastern Conference. And I want you to start us off here, John, with your number one team in the Eastern Conference.
Well, it is the Detroit Pistons. And I know that we all know that they need to prove themselves in the postseason. But look at what they did against the Knicks last year in that playoff series, which could have gone the other way had they been able to execute a little bit better and maybe gotten a slightly better whistle or two late in a game or two in that series. But the fact is, Detroit has arrived, and they're 42-13. And, you know, you think about it with the Isaiah Stewart suspension, they have been able to fight on. And that win over the Knicks, Kevin, is why I have Detroit at number one this past week. That was really impressive. In a game where you thought Karl Anthony Towns was going to feast, you feel like the Knicks are still trying to figure out what they're going to look like under Mike Brown. And guess what? They don't have a year or two to figure it out. Figure it out now, like soon. But Cade Cunningham has become as good as anybody in clutch time in the NBA. He's absolutely ridiculous. And this team defensively is locked in. Like, you got to look at the way they're guarding night in, night out. They've allowed just 102.5 points per 100 possessions over their five-game winning streak. And that's come against teams that are pretty good on the offensive end of the floor. But I just like this team setup. I know that you could say, okay, if Cade has an off night, how do they compensate for that on the perimeter, and do they have enough supplemental shot making? But the Detroit Pistons are at the top of the East. I'm wondering if you agree with me or not.
I don't agree. I don't have the Pistons number one. I'll reveal my number one a little bit later, but sticking with Detroit, they're undeniably great, right? That they're 42-13. They have the best record in the NBA. They have a 116.8 offensive rating, a 108.3 defensive rating. Their defense is awesome. Number two in the league right now. If Detroit wins the finals, it's going to be because their defense is so dominant and their offense is good enough. You know, Cade has enough big nights. You know, Duncan Robinson or Tobias Harris or whoever it may be has enough good shooting performances, big games where they get hot, and their defense is just stabilizing the team all the way to the finals. That's part of their identity. But they're 27th in the NBA in three-point attempts per game. They're 19th in the NBA in three-point percentage. And you mentioned the creation aside from Cade Cunningham, John. I'm also just concerned about the shooting in general. Do you think the Pistons have enough shooting to actually be the team that hoists the trophy at the end of the year?
That's the problem. Like, they're first in my rankings because they've dominated the New York Knicks, and they've shown me to this point when you've won 42 of your 55 games, you're getting that number one spot because we'll get to some of the questions I have with some of these other teams, but you don't really question in 2026 basketball to be, do you have enough complementary shooting and do you have enough three-point shooting? And you're right. I mean, let's face it. This is a team that is going to be relying on Tobias Harris to step up in a big way, and Duncan Robinson to knock down shots. But the fact is, with where they're at, if it's not hitting, you know, when you look at it, if it's not Cunningham and Robinson, who, you know, he hit 5 of 10 in a recent win over the Bulls. He took 10 threes from there. Like, that to me is the biggest thing with this team, is because when you look at it, their bench, like, look, Paul Reed's had a hell of a season. And he is the league's, you know, one of the he's the league's best third string center. So in the front court, this team doesn't have problems. Like, that's not their issue. But we all know it's a perimeter shot making game, which is why I have a gut feeling on number one, and maybe I'll guess before you get into it, because there's a team in the Eastern Conference that has no shortage of perimeter shot making upside. The Pistons, no, they don't have enough shooting, and no, they're not going to win the NBA Finals for me. They're not. They wouldn't be my pick. Like, if you made me pick, now I'm talking myself out of this on your show. If you made me pick one, team in the East, I still wouldn't pick them. But when I'm ranking these teams today, like, these are two different arguments. Detroit gets the number one nod because I go off what they've shown us. But on the stability map, on the trustability map, if that's such a thing, I just made that term up. It's not Detroit, you know, and it's not even New York with Mike Brown, and it's not Cleveland, which means there's one other team that would be on the trustworthy map. Because guess what? I don't care that they're still waiting on an injured player to come back. Team has won a championship and has a coach who's won a championship.
Well, the reason why the trust factor with Detroit, their defense is dominant. You know, Pistons fans who listen to this podcast know how much I love Isaiah Stewart. I know he's out right now because of the suspension, but Isaiah Stewart is awesome. I think he's the sixth man of the year favorite. They have so many players. Jalen Duren, the leap he's taken. They have so many good players. And Cade Cunningham is in the top five MVP conversation. That game he had against the Knicks, 42 points on 17 to 34, 13 assists. He was unbelievable. And he looked like an MVP that game. And I think it's worth comparing Cade Cunningham to last year's most valuable player, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Just to understand, like, the difference in SGA and Cade. Like, SGA is just on another level in terms of scoring efficiency. 67% true shooting to 56.9% for Cade Cunningham. In the pick and roll, SGA scores 1.2 points per pick and roll to 0.98 for Cade Cunningham. Isolations, same difference. Spot up opportunities. This is like catch and shoot. This is attacking the closeout, pulling up for mid-range, finishing at the basket. SGA is 1.21 points per spot up to 0.89 for Cade Cunningham. And so when you look at the top 10 MVP candidates by odds, so these are the top 10 candidates according to the sports books out there. SGA, no surprise, is number two. Jokic is number one. But Cade Cunningham is last of the 10 MVP candidates in true shooting percentage. And so Cade has taken this big leap. And I don't mean this out of disrespect. I mean this from a place of awareness for Pistons fans. Cade is really, really good. And he's a most valuable player and candidate for the regular season. But I don't have the trust factor for him yet in the postseason to be the engine, the primary guy to lead your team to a championship like SGA last year with the Thunder.
But SGA has the luxury of he's sitting out here with his injury, and on a big Sunday game, Isaiah Joe and Cason Wallace can go out and still help the Thunder, help guide the Thunder past a red-hot Cavs team. SGA is surrounded by Jalen Williams, by Chet Holmgren, by championship. That team is incredibly well-constructed. And I think when we headed towards the NBA trade deadline, one of the biggest questions that I was wondering was, you know, will we see Detroit significantly? You know, will we see something significant happen for them to have the true Robin or the true, you know, Mitchell Harden type combo? Because if Cade had that level of a guy with him, I think you would change how you feel about Detroit. I know that you would, but this is just in the NBA. This is what we've seen in the NBA playoffs now for years. Defense amps up. Your best player is going to have a game or two where they just don't perform to their best ability. So I'm not blaming Cade as much as when I look at this roster, I say, and Oklahoma City's got the perfect roster. They really do. But when I look at this roster, do I say, do they have enough sugar and spice from beyond the arc that says he's getting zoned in? How are they moving the ball? And the other thing is this, and I think he's done a hell of a job, but J.B. Bickerstaff has had trouble in the playoffs. You know, running offense at times, late in games, a discussion point that we have talked about in the past on your pod has been something that when you're watching evidence, you say, okay, well, what were they doing there late in the game? So these are the demons that Detroit has to exercise. But Kevin, we both know this. The only way that you do it is by actually showing up and figuring out a way to do it. The problem is that I think the East is maybe it's not better, but it certainly could be deeper than we expected it to be.
That's why we get four, right? That's why we're talking about four teams right now and not just two or one at the top of the Eastern Conference. And I think for Detroit this week, they have San Antonio on Monday night on Peacock. That's the early game before you're on at night. And then OKC on Wednesday, Cleveland on Friday. This week, talk about a barometer test for already right now the best team by record in the NBA. But let's move to my number one team in the Eastern Conference. This is the team that I think is most likely to represent the Eastern Conference in the NBA Finals, and that's the Boston Celtics.
There it is.
The Boston Celtics are most likely to represent the East in the NBA Finals. This team, without Jason Tatum this year, 37-19, fourth best record in the NBA, 120.1 offensive rating. It doesn't matter who's out there. They are lights out. 112.2 defensive rating, third best net rating in the entire NBA. The Celtics, John, I feel like so much of the conversation this year, and rightfully so, is about Jaylen Brown. He calls himself the best two-way player in basketball. He is in the top five MVP conversation. He's been unbelievable. He's been excellent. But what's often not talked about is how amazing Boston is without Jaylen Brown as well. Like, the Celtics this year, they're a plus 5.2 net rating with Jaylen Brown on the floor. They're a plus 14.1 without Jaylen Brown on the floor this season. So the Celtics, as hard to believe as it is, people talk about how dominant they are without Jason Tatum. How about how dominant they are without Jason Tatum and without Jaylen Brown, without both of them? It's hard to fathom.
How about this from Celtics stats? Third time in franchise history. The history of this great franchise that the Celtics have completed the California sweep, beating the Clippers, Kings, Lakers, and Warriors on the road by an average of 19.5 points. They not only won the games, they won the games by close to 20 points per game. Is that not enough to convince you? The Celtics held 14 opponents to 100 points or less this season, 7 of their last 11. Kevin, they're not just really good. And by the way, watching them more closely over the last, 2 weeks, including the Sunday night basketball game against the Lakers, which, by the way, side note, and yes, I am biased, but I got to say, I love the Sunday night NBC window for the NBA. I think it's phenomenal for the league. And it just it feels like a playoff game, which is everything the league's got to be thinking about and all that. This was such an impressive performance from Boston. You know, on a night where they're honoring Pat Riley in L.A., you got the stars out. You knew L.A. was going to try to bring it. Peyton Pritchard's a killer. You know, Peyton Pritchard and Sam Hauser came out, and they were drilling shots early in the game. Kata, I mean, he had two blocks on LeBron James. He's gotten better as the year's gone on. I love this note about Pritchard. He had 30-plus points, 5-plus assists, 5-plus threes off the bench for the second time in his career. The only other Celtic to do that is D. Brown. That was over 30 years ago. Not to mention, wow, Pritchard joined this in the NBA. Larry Bird and Kevin McHale is the only Celtics to record 25-plus points off the bench in three consecutive games. This guy's on a heater. Like, he has turned into a different monster. You know, did we have them starting Baylor Shireman in a Sunday night basketball game in October, Kevin, and winning in this manifest? I just think it just shows you the circumstances. And Joe Mazzulla deserves to very much be there in Coach of the Year. And for people who are like, well, he has Brown and he has White and they've got championship DNA. Yeah, but you lost an MVP type of player and people had you at 6th, 7th, or 8th in the East. I don't even know where you had them in the preseason. And right now you could argue that they're the best team in this conference.
Joe Mazzulla, I mean, I think he's the number one reason, if you want to talk about, you know, how this team constantly plays so hard and puts in effort. I had Drew Carter, Celtics play-by-play announcer, on a couple weeks ago, and he was just talking about how Mazzulla and the belief he instills in this team and all that. They just never stop on defense. Like, the win they had against the Rockets starting Ron Harper Jr., and then last night against the Lakers with Baylor Shireman as the primary defender against Luka, and then Peyton Pritchard. I mean, you said it. I mean, part of the reason why they're able to excel with or without Jaylen Brown out there is Peyton Pritchard. This year, I mean, he goes from a sixth man of the year candidate last season to starting most of the games, and he just come off the bench lately. But Pritchard, man, since the Simons trade, 23.6 points per game, 6.4 assists per game, nearly 50-40-90 efficiency, only 2.7 turnovers per game. The amount of shot diversity from this guy, his ability to get to the basket, finish with his left hand, the ability to finish through contact, the mid-range game, some of the fadeaways that he hits, the ability to create space off the dribble. Peyton Pritchard scores in every single which way possible, no matter the type of defender. He has become such a highly efficient and high volume scorer with necessary. And all these highlights on screen, if you're watching on YouTube, are without Jaylen Brown on the floor. So with Pritchard during this stretch since February 3rd, when Simons was traded, the creation and the playmaking is truly elite over the last 20 days or so. And all year, he's been very, very good with more on his plate without Jason Tatum out there. He's amazing. And I think that just speaks to how with Boston, they have so many different guys who can go off offensively, who can handle the ball offensively, who can defend multiple positions. And everybody on the team from 1 to 15, everybody plays hard constantly. Everybody plays hard. Everybody's bought into the mission. And I'm constantly blown away by this team, John. And I think, you know, you mentioned Baylor Shireman as well with what he can do defensively. I thought that in that game between the Celtics and Lakers, they started the game with Baylor Shireman defending Luka. Yep. And then Hugo Gonzalez, their rookie late first-round draft pick as well, he defended Luka on a bunch of possessions too. And those two together and, you know, Jaylen Brown a handful of possessions, a bunch of different guys, the pressure they put on Luka in that, they stayed home on shooters, they forced Luka to shoot, and they made it tough on him. And they playing one-on-one because they know Luka wasn't trying to get to the basket. He's taken a career low 9% of his shot attempts he's taken a career low percent of unassisted shot attempts at the rim. So they're just knowing that he's going to take mid-range fadeaways and mid-range pull-ups. They're baiting him into it all game long while staying home on other guys and helping off of some of the non-shooters like Marcus Smart. I thought it was a magnificent defensive game plan by Boston, pressuring the ball handler, and then with Luka just playing him one-on-one the far majority of the game. And again, like, that speaks to the game planning, but also the depth Boston has with their amount of different defenders. They can throw at star players like Luka and constantly execute and play at a high level. I'm blown away by this team.
And if you're Detroit, you want to avoid Boston until the conference finals. I mean, you want to avoid Boston in general.
You want to avoid Boston, period. You want them to get out, eliminated.
Well, exactly, you do. But I'm saying if you have to face them in the conference finals, at that point, it's the conference finals. It is what it is. That's kind of my thought process. You do not want to have to play them. They're a bad matchup for Detroit, in my humble opinion.
Yes.
Like, they are, because you're not going to shut Boston down offensively. Like, you can't just totally turn the water off. They've got too many different shot makers and too many different threats, which is the antithesis of Detroit. Like, Detroit You know where it's coming from. And can it happen? Of course it can happen. Like, again, they can. It's very hard, though, Kevin, at some point in a playoff series, it's very hard to consistently muck it up and not get into a fourth quarter of shot making. And you've got to draw up different forms of offense. You've got to draw up a different counter. And here's the biggest reason why I as you do these power rankings, like, you've talked me into why Boston is number one, and I sense that for me on my address, even though, like, I think I'm almost positive I gave you a non-Celtics as number two. And I don't know if graphics can update it, but I absolutely think Boston, then I really do think that they're number two in this ranking. I'll make the case for the other team, though, in number two. I'm fine to do it. But this is my favorite Boston, though.
One real quick thing, though. Yeah. I mean, I think with Boston, I mean, the name we haven't mentioned, Tatum, and like, part of it is he will be back. Like, he will be back at some point, and I know, you know, when it comes to that conversation, people say, "Well, what are you going to get out of him? How's he going to look? Is he going to stay healthy?" I don't know. I mean, this team already is one of the best teams in basketball without him. And if whatever he can add, he doesn't need to be a primary. If he can just add his size and length at 6'9" and defend and rebound and play multiple positions and hit spot up threes, That's a positive addition for Boston. You don't need full-strength Jason Tatum. That's part of the reason why I put them number one, John.
Also, even like slightly below average what Jason Tatum normally is could be enough to get this team over the top. Could be more than enough to get this team over the top. So, like, yeah, there's experience, but it's the defense for me that's gotten better. Over the last couple weeks, they've like 11th or 12th in the NBA. In defense to like seventh right now.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. Here's the other thing. The biggest reason why is that they rank second in opponent field goal percentage in the paint, just over 53%. And they're first in the NBA in the lowest percentage of their opponent shots that even come in the paint. Only 44% of opponent shots come in the paint. So, when we're talking about Detroit, that is a big issue there in that head-to-head matchup. But we've laid it out there. I mean, Boston right now, Boston is a great pick because they don't even have a guy that if he comes back and gives them even decent Jason Tatum, holy cow!
But my other thought from that Lakers-Celtics game: do the Lakers have a championship identity? I don't think they do. The Lakers don't look like a team that has a championship identity. When you juxtapose the way Boston was playing, everybody hustling, everybody trying hard, everybody draining threes, making plays off the dribble, playing with tempo in the half court, and then you look at the Lakers, it's your turn, my turn, stagnant offense. The Lakers had 239 passes in the game to 315 for the Celtics. They score 89 points. They're complaining. They're getting technical fouls called on them. They're crying. They look like a team that is just going to flame out in the first or second round. They don't look like a team that has the mentality to go deep in the playoffs at all. LeBron not getting back on defense. Luka crying and whining. Gained all the weight back as well. I mean, it's like he doesn't get to the rim. He's getting to the rim at a career low rate. He's settling for jumpers. And like, I know he's averaging 32 points per game. He's still an amazing player. I'm not taking that away from him. He has managed to adapt to his new style. But part of the success with him in the past in the postseason was his ability to get to the basket relentlessly if the shot wasn't falling. And he doesn't do it as much anymore. And so, like, this team, I don't think they have the mentality. I got my questions about the personnel as well. Never mind defensively, but offensively, what level they're reaching the playoffs. I just thought against the Celtics, that looked like a team that was together. The Lakers looked like a team that was playing for themselves. There's just a big difference between Boston and LA.
It was Boston Celtics toughness, identity, DNA, everything that organization stands for. And on the other side was sit back at the beach, Hollywood, sunglasses, and not the right kind. It wasn't the right. On a night where Pat Riley was honored, you saw like how far the Lakers are from that level of the glory days. And you might have the star power. That doesn't mean it's a great example of today's NBA. Like, yes, you do need superstar power, but you need team. And they don't have depth. They don't have depth. Like, it's got to be LeBron, Luka, Reeves. Now that he's, I know that they're, that, you know, now they're getting healthier and whatnot, but I don't believe in their, in their depth. I don't believe in their supplemental shot makers enough. I mean, Marcus Smart in this game plays 22 minutes. He goes 0 for 7 from the floor. But then I think, Kevin, as is, they have their defensive deficiencies. When they don't make shots, those deficiencies go up by 10 because they then let their defense affect. They let their offense affect how they then defend. They already have trouble guarding, but those things get amplified when they're not making shots. And Boston got into them. Boston said, "We're here to play, and we're going to go BTA here." And they commanded the game. The Lakers got within 7, and then Kata was through the rim on that wonky sequence, and JJ gets a tech, and then they never really got back on track for the Lakers.
And that seems to happen so often with them, which is very, very frustrating. It feels like just a gap year for the Lakers, and then next year, figure it out. John, what's your next team on your list? We've talked about your number one with the Pistons, my number one with the Celtics. Who do you have next?
So I will make the case, because in my original list to you, I believe that I have the New York Knicks at number two. So For the sake of the debate, I will make the case for the New York Knicks number two, because we've talked at length about Boston and how good they are. Now, I'm not just saying it for one singular game, because I've watched the Knicks a number of times. Heck of a comeback win over Houston on Saturday. And the Madison Square Garden plays a role in any playoff series and the atmosphere that it can generate and how it can throw a visitor off. I also think the Knicks match up better with the Boston Celtics than the Detroit Pistons would. And so maybe that's why my argument's a little bit skewed here towards the Knicks. And I'm banking on the fact that they could still figure some things out. When they played in Boston on Super Sunday, and again, like, look, you know, is everybody at full strength there? Jason Tatum's still not back. But the Knicks did a brilliant job defending Boston. And Boston's one side of their style was shown in this game, where it's high three-point volume. And if you face a team that comes ready physically, and I thought the Knicks were ready that day, physically and on the glass, they won that game 111-89, and Boston shot 7 of 41 from three-point territory. You know, remember, the psychology of New York and Boston is a little different. Yes, we know about the Tatum injury, but at the end of the day, Kevin, there's benefits to winning a playoff series over a team, and the Knicks did that last year. They were able to break through under a different coach. And I would say right now, I don't know about you, but yeah, you have some trust issues with how things are working between the players and Mike Brown. There's some cryptic quotes after certain games. You know, I read Karl Anthony Towns say after the Detroit game, like, this is how our offense works, and this is the process of what our staff and everybody believes, you know, like, we're trying to do to get to where we want to be. And Kevin, the answer made me scratch my head and say, I don't know. I don't think that this is working in the here and now. And I don't know if Mike Brown and his staff are fully in touch with what the players want to see and with what this needs to get to, because it's not the level that it needs to be at, even after a comeback win over Houston. They got embarrassed. They got embarrassed in a primetime game on the home court Detroit team that's missing their best two big men. That should not have happened. But when I put the Knicks at number two, I put the Knicks at number two because Jalen Brunson's a killer. And if Bridges gives his best and OG puts out his best and Josh Hart is doing the dirty work, there's enough there for me to say, why not the Knicks? But the elephant in the room, I'd be curious to get your thought on this. To me, the elephant in the room is, what are you getting in a playoff series against the elite from number 32, Karl Anthony Towns? Mm. Is that your elephant in the room with the Knicks?
It is. Yeah. I think it's largely Karl Anthony Towns. I mean, talked about him a bunch all year long, obviously, with the ups and downs, even just right before opening night when he's like, I'm not sure about the clarity of my role. I don't know what my role is going to look like. Just a weird year from start to today with Karl Anthony Towns. So I think that's the big one. But it's also just the collective, you know, the Brunson cat togetherness, those two on the floor together. Still defensively, you have questions about those two on the floor in a postseason setting. I do think they you're not going to rule out the Knicks. Like, you can't rule out the Knicks. They've been great this past month. They've been playing their best defense of the entire season this past month. So you're not going to rule out this team with OG Anunoby and Mikal Bridges and the bodies that they have. Even adding Jeremy Sochan as a depth guy at the wing position as another defender you can throw out there. And then not to mention Jose Alvarado. Alvarado was a key figure in that comeback win against the Houston Rockets. He had five steals in that game. He's played five games for the Knicks. He has five steals in two of them. Just the way he is defensively, flying around, doing what he does, the Grand Theft Alvarado stuff, where he just beats players. I mean, off of rebounds, he's there. He manages to find the ball. Off-ball situations, his ability to kind of play free safety and just surprise players. He just, like, you know he's there. It's just, you can't, when you have the ball in your hands, you can't think of everything. You can't always think of where Jose Alvarado's going to be on the floor. That guy just amazes me. In that Houston game, it was a lot of Brunson Alvarado. You would think, like, a two smalls against a bigger Houston lineup would be a problem. But with Alvarado, he plays bigger than his body is. And so, like, with the Knicks, I bring that back to your initial question. They have lineup versatility. They have different ways that they can play. They can play with two bigs. They can play with one big. They can play with a lob center in Mitchell Robinson or a spacing center in Karl-Anthony Towns. They can play with two guards. They can play with a feisty guard in Alvarado, or they can lean more towards scoring. And so I think, like, they have different ways that they can play. And I really value, and I think lineup flexibility, diversity in the way you play out there. And so the Knicks have that. I'd put them three. I have Celtics one, Pistons two, Knicks three. I'm sorry, I have the Knicks fourth, but it's very close. Very close Woo! Between them and Cleveland. So I have the Knicks fourth, but I wouldn't rule out the Knicks.
Really?
I wouldn't rule them out. I think all four of these teams have a shot. But I'm putting them behind Cleveland for now. But, you know, I wouldn't rule them out. I wouldn't rule them out, John. You think that's crazy, putting the Knicks fourth?
Well, because Cleveland's got to prove it to me in the playoffs. They have to show. And the thing with Cleveland is Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. Allen more so. Allen, who's been on a tear. I mean, over the last, like, 2.5-3 weeks, there has not been a more productive big man in the NBA, if you look at the numbers. Jared Allen has been on a mammoth tear for the Cavs. You see, I've got them at four, and I've got them at which is self-explanatory, to see Boston at three. And revisiting this argument, Boston's no lower than two for me now, but keep them three for the sake of argument here, because it's more fun discussion for you and I. Cleveland is four because defensively, I don't know if I can trust their combination of players quite yet, because Harden, like, they're doing so many different things on the offensive end of the floor, but the Cavs, like, Mobley is an elite defender. We're going to get back to him in a second. He's an elite defender. But this is a team that has not been able to prove that they can consistently string it together on the defensive end of the floor. I mean, they're currently sitting at 12th in the NBA in defensive rating, and that's lower than the other three teams that we're considering here, and it's lower than, you know, Miami, Toronto, who I think is feisty and a very interesting team. And it's hovering right around the Magic, who frankly have been underwhelming. Now, they're fifth in offensive rating. New York are ahead of them in that column. So I know why you've got them three. And I think you've got them three because at the end of the day, Donovan Mitchell and James Harden with Mobley, Allen, and the core, there's more different ways to beat a defense. And there's more star power there, superstar power, and buckability on the perimeter than there is in Detroit on paper. But these games aren't decided on paper. And the Cavaliers, Donovan Mitchell is dealing with the pressure of not making a conference finals. And so are the Cavs. And Allen, for as good as he's been the last 3 weeks, back to the initial point, Allen has had playoff demons. Evan Mobley's lack of offense and lack of ways that he can score has shown up in the playoffs where teams are saying, we'll dare you to shoot. And sometimes those have been converted, but there's been a lot of times where they have not. And then you say, okay, you know, can a Sam Merrill consistently show up? Can Jalen Tyson transcend the playoffs? Like last year in the beginning of the playoffs, Ty Jerome has a massive game. And then you're thinking maybe Cleveland has a different gear. Maybe that gear is going to be seen here. Then they got pushed around. They got pushed around. They got out-muscled. They were weaker mentally. Is James Harden going to lift this team mentally in the playoffs? Have some of his been because he's been in the very, very difficult Western Conference, and now in the East, he's going to be able to function properly with Donovan Mitchell? These are real questions that the Cavs have to answer still.
I think they're all real questions. And I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people shouting at the podcast right now saying, James Harden's also a choker. That's what they're saying. Like Harden's a choker. Like that's part of it out there. I think with Harden, you know, fair complaint in some of the game sevens and whatnot. But as I've said many, many times over the years of the podcast, like you can't just ignore some of the highs he's experienced in the playoffs either. And I think with, you mentioned the pressure of this team. And that's part of it. Like you can look at that as a negative, but you can also look at it as a positive. This is a team that hasn't gotten over a hump with players who haven't gotten over the hump. Mitchell, of course, still younger, but James Harden as well. Who's to say he's not going to be like Jason Kidd winning his first finals at 38, right? Or Kevin Garnett at 32 with Boston, or Dirk at 32. Like there's these star players who have won their first finals later in their careers. And so with James Harden, that's very possible. And I think with Harden as well, the playmaking ability, what he adds, is very clearly already an upgrade over Darius Garland. The chemistry that he's already developing with Jared Allen, I'm impressed by. It hasn't shown quite in the numbers yet, results-wise, but those guys look good together. They've run about 15, 16 pick and rolls per game together. And overall, I like the fact his usage is lower this season for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's scoring 18.7 points per game, down from 25.4 with the Clippers. Taking 11.5 shots per game, down from 17.5 per game with the Clippers. He's running 23 pick and rolls per game, down from 31.6 with the Clippers. So you're getting more with less with James Harden. There's less on his plate, and he's able to pick his spots more, where he's some nights going to be the fourth scorer for your team or the third scorer on your team. And then there's other nights when he's feeling it, where he can be your number one. And so I think that's where I look at Harden in this Cavs ecosystem. And I'm like, okay, you're going to typically get the best out of Harden considering the other options that are out there. And so I have them third in part for that reason, John.
But one thing, like Sunday afternoon, the Cavs, They kind of made fools.
They laid an egg.
What's that?
They laid an egg.
Well, they laid an egg, but they also then followed it up by complaining that the Thunder foul and that it's not called. First off, they're the reigning champions. They're at home. They guard. Like, okay, you wanted more fouls? You weren't winning the game with more. Let's just say it's three or four more whistles. I'm sorry, you weren't. Look at this. Defensively, they didn't come ready to play. I mean, the start was slow. Did they finish stronger? I guess. But like Oklahoma City, shorthanded. You're down multiple marquee stars, and it didn't matter because the Cavaliers don't have a consistent defense, and then they get pushed around. That's the biggest thing, Kevin, is that the Cavs have not had that edge. And that's why, so you've got the Knicks down to four. The Knicks have still shown me in the springtime more of an edge from their leaders than we've seen from the Cavs. But as we've talked about, the only way that you fight off that demon is by showing us it. They have, everyone's like, well, the Knicks have an immense amount of pressure to win a championship. You don't go and get James Harden unless you feel an immense amount of pressure to win now.
100%. They feel it. And I mean, look, Garland wasn't giving you anything. He was out. And so he's definitely an upgrade over him. They still need to get Max Strus back. Kenny Atkinson says he's going to play the season. Well, we haven't seen him all year. But well, when do we see him?
By the way, I'll believe it. How many times do we talk about Garland on this show? You and I have had spent a lot of time. And I like Darius and wish him very well, and think a change in destination for him is a good thing. But it wasn't working.
No, it wasn't working. That's why they did what they did. I love the Keon Ellis acquisition. I think with Cleveland, three or four, you know, I've really wavered between my list. Celtics 1, Pistons 2, Cavs 3, Knicks 4. You have the Pistons first, Knicks 2, Celtics 3, Cavs 4. It feels like if you were flipping it, maybe now you'd put the Celtics ahead of the Knicks, and I might be putting the Knicks ahead of the Cavaliers after our conversation. But that's our top four Eastern Conference contenders. Do the Raptors belong in this conversation? Do they deserve contender status, John? Or are we correct to leave them out of this?
Well, here's what I'll say. This is some food for thought, okay? The Cavs at 36-22 are three games ahead of where the Pacers were at this time last year. At this time last year, the Indiana Pacers were 33-25. Toronto deserves to be in the conversation because of flaws of the four that we've just brought up. Now, the least flawed teams, the most bulletproof team, is the team that you have number one at the end of the day if they have shot-making to the degree that we think that they can have, and if their defense continues to ascend. The only argument against Boston is that, like, Mazzulla's done an unbelievable job with this team in season, that in the playoffs we're going to see different teams, you know, reveal some flaws in them because they're getting after them harder. They're elevating their play in the playoffs. But Toronto deserves to have, I don't want to say contender status, but they absolutely deserve to be in the room with ahead of a table and the dinner table. We know who the chairs are at the front four seats. Like, there are other teams who I would not put there. But Toronto.
They're sitting at the kids' table. That's what it is. They're sitting at the kids. Oh, they're the waiter. Wow, you're going waiter. I was going to say they're at the kids' table.
Wait, no, you ever see what is it, Emperor's New Groove, the Disney movie?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Well, in that movie, there's poison in the movie. So Kronk poisons, you know, they pull off a scheme, right? Hopefully somebody on your show understands this. Toronto's the waiter. Toronto's the waiter that could come in and you know, do something shady and send all four down, and they somehow emerge out of the Eastern Conference. I would not. Why? Because versatility is an elite trait to have in the NBA, and they have multiple guys who are defined as matchup nightmares that they could play through, whether it's Ingram, whether it's Barnes, whether it's the burst ability from Quickly. Like, Toronto's a feisty team. They are tough to guard.
Canada, there's John to make you feel better after Team USA hockey won gold on Sunday in the Olympics, a 2-1 overtime victory. Jack Hughes overtime goal after losing teeth to a high stick. USA gold, first gold since 1980 for the hockey team, since the Do You Believe in Miracles team in 1980. What a game, man. That was unbelievable. Unbelievable to watch.
It was absolutely exceptional. It's a reminder that the Olympics brings us all together. And the way that they were getting outplayed for that third period and a good majority of the second, and to fight through it, and for Jack Hughes, with one or two teeth down and all, to step up and deliver this moment. It's one of the iconic moments in American sports history. It's a moment that you say, remember that. And it feels like in our sports climate, sometimes these days it's all about, like, you know, everything is the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. Yesterday was a moment where even several hours after the game, Kevin, that was living on, and it's going to live on forever. It's an unbelievable moment for hockey. It is also a reflection on the pressure that you have on you as a country. You know, this is a basketball linkage here. The United States has real pressure in the 2028 LA Games on the men's basketball side to stave off Victor Wembanyama in France and to find a pathway to the gold on home soil. That gold medal game could be one of the largest and biggest, you know, gold medal games that we've ever seen, because it is on, it's in United States soil, and we're seeing basketball, the globalization of it, only continue to provide more competition and more heated games. And that's the thing with hockey is, you know, the United States, this is now their golden age. It was tremendous to watch. And not only that, but a shout out to my NBC teammates, you know, Kenny Albert, Eddie Olczyk, Brian and Catherine, and then the capper for Mike Tirico,
awesome.
GOAT status. His close was unbelievable. That's why we love sports. Yesterday, sports brings people together. It was awesome for everyone involved.
Yeah, that Mike Tirico close was awesome. I mean, the way he brought it from, you know, last time USA was here, these guys were 10, 14 years old. They had a dream. You know, for all the young people out there, this is where dreams are formed. Or, you know, go out there and get it. Yeah, go chase those dreams. It was just such a great monologue from him, you know, because our country loves sports and it brings us together unlike anything else. Tirico was amazing. How does that guy go from on a one day of the week announcing NBA games, and then he's doing the Super Bowl, and then weeks later he's in Italy at the Olympics announcing games, giving out monologues, closing the ceremony? Dude's a legend. His status keeps rising and rising. He's amazing.
He's an unbelievable role model, you know, for somebody like myself to have. Mike he's fantastic. He's a great person, and he genuinely cares, you know, in terms of his ability to do his job with different sports. It's unmatched in the industry. It's in a class of its own. And the way that he brings knowledge to the table every single time he puts the microphone on, but also does it in the most humbling of ways, is such an it's such an amazing combination. And Mike is he's really special. When I joined NBC, within 5 the announcement being made, Mike and I had never talked before. Within 5 minutes, Mike Tirico reached out with a message of congratulations and wishing you luck and always here if you need anything. He didn't have to do that. He doesn't have to do that. He's best sportscaster on the planet, and he did. So credit to Mike. I'm so happy for him, and he's unbelievable. And it's also a great portrayal, Kevin, of like, and your show, you bring up data on your show. Like, now in sports media, there's so much hot take city. Mike was storytelling. Like, that's a big thing that I think about with the NBA, that I think the new broadcast partners are doing. ESPN's continued to rise in that, but like sort of the new landscape of the league, we're seeing within these shows just more storytelling, more here's the context, here's something to consider when you're talking about these teams and these players. People want that. They want to gravitate to that. They want to feel like they know people and know the players and know what drives them. That matters, and it should. In a finals last year in the league where we saw the Thunder and the Pacers, a lot of people went into it being like, how interesting is this going to be? Da-da-da. No, when we got to the core of it, the basketball was really fun, and the storytelling was so productive for the game. People are starving for that again. That's what Mike Tirico does at an unmatched level.
I mean, when you're talking about storytelling, I'm thinking about the Tyler Loop missed field goal as the time ticked off in the playoffs when the Ravens lost to the Steelers, and Tirico, the call was like, they interviewed all these kickers, and it leads to moments like this. Like, he's storytelling leading up to the moment. Just the dude's a master at what he does. And you're calling Wolves Blazers on Tuesday, NBA on NBC, your debut play-by-play. How'd you find out about it, John?
Yeah, it's a great story. So on December the 18th, Christmas came a week early for me. So I was emceeing an NBC roundtable. I was emceeing an NBC roundtable that recapping 2025 and previewing the year ahead, which featured legendary February between the Super Bowl, the Milan Olympics, the All-Star Game, and everything else happening. And as part of that round table, which I was thrilled to be asked to MC, we had Rick Cordella, president at NBC Sports. We had Sam Flood. We had Lindsay Signer, who does a terrific job on the marketing side. And then we had Frank DeGrace, who oversees everything in the NBA with NBC coming on. He did an incredible job with Nets on Yes. People love the Yes presentations of the Nets with Ian, Sarah, and so on. That crew, Frank comes over to NBC, and he's now taking on that role and leading the way. And so I'm emceeing the roundtable, Kevin. And one of the last questions was, what would make Legendary February a success? We go around the room to Rick and Sam and Lindsay, and we get to Molly Solomon as well. I forgot Molly, who just did a little job at the Olympics. So Molly was with us as well, and they all get done. And Frank was last for this question. And Frank said, well, Legendary February, you know, we're all over it. We're excited for the All-Star game, and we want to, you know, make All-Star weekend big again and get it going. And he's like, what will also make February special is that John Fanta will make his NBA and NBC play-by-play debut on February 24th in Portland. And I did not know that was coming. That was a total surprise. He announced it at a town hall in front of our hundreds of employees that were in the room. And Kevin, the most humbling part about it is that I had done a lot of college football studio stuff in the fall and have been working a lot of college games early in the season. A good amount of those people that work in our big broadcast center and came over to watch the town hall and they're sitting there. And a good amount of them, you know, started to applaud. That is that's extremely humbling from a standpoint of all you ever want to do in this industry is be a good teammate. And when you hear that from the people that you've worked with, I've been with the company since August. I've been with NBC Sports since August. That's why we do it. We do it for the joy of it. I do it for the joy of it. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. And my jaw hit the floor because I was thrilled to get asked by Frank. I appreciate that from Frank. And he and Sam Flood and Elise Noonan, you know, they give me this opportunity. I can't wait for it. So the story caught me by surprise. Christmas truly came 1 week early.
It's awesome. What a story. That's such a good way to find out about it. That's better than like just an email, right?
And then after that answer, who came out by surprise because he happened to be in the building for some promos for the Olympics? Mike Tirico comes out.
Wow.
And I do a one-on-one with Mike for 15 minutes, which was the best.
What a dream.
It was a dream day. And, you know, that's why it's very, very grateful to get the opportunity to be attached in any way to the NBA and NBC brand, which people are seeing with the elements and with the nostalgia, but also this new flavor and the new graphics and the different look. It's about celebrating this sport. And I can't wait to be a part of it on Tuesday night in Portland with Jamal Crawford and Grant Lifman and our entire crew.
That's awesome, John. I mean, that's pretty awesome, man. What a way to find out. One of those moments you'll always have the rest of your life. One of those like, wow, I can't believe I get to do what I do types of opportunities. Who are you most looking forward to watching from courtside? I don't assume Anthony Edwards, but I have to ask anyway.
Well, it absolutely is Ant-Man. I can't wait to see him play and see him out there, because I just think he's as big a face as there is in the league. He's certainly as big a personality. And you think of what he's already accomplished with back-to-back Western Conference Finals trips. And we all know what now everybody wants. Everybody wants to see, all right, can he elevate them to the finals? Can they get to that next gear? And yeah, they've been outside the top five in the West. They missed out on a chance to gain some ground on Sunday. They were shorthanded. They're down, you know, guys with Rudy Gobert out serving a suspension due to the flagrants, and then they didn't have Naz Reid. But yeah, I'm so fascinated to watch this this Minnesota team in person, because I do think when they hit their top gear, there's no question. See it. You can see why they can go on another playoff run. I think it's fascinating that Chris Finch has said, you know, Jaden McDaniels, we want a target of 10 shots a game at least. And then what Dante DiVincenzo can give them, you know, and when they've got everybody on deck and they've got a Julius Rosen fully engaged and playing his level, like that to me determines what their ceiling can be. Is if Randall gives them, if Randall's here, if he's at his best level, he and Ann, they're really, really difficult to stop. And when this team can put some defense and string some things together, I mean, their defensive rating with Rudy versus without him is staggering. I don't think there's a bigger difference in the NBA in terms of who they are with him on the floor versus who they are without him on the floor. So, you know, look, this is a team that I think is like 120 versus 108. That's how big of a difference Rudy Gobert makes. Overall in the season, they're at 112.6. But I'm excited to watch Ant. I wish that we had Denny Avdia. I hope we do. He went out of the game against the Suns with a back. So that's tough because I love the Denny story, you know, to be the first Israeli-born All-Star is a great story. But Donovan Klingon, to me, has taken a really nice step. He's having a very nice season.
Shooting threes.
he's shooting threes, which doesn't surprise me because he's worked on that. And I'm going to share something that might surprise some people. In the history of the Blazers here, as we're getting ready for this game, I wrote this down this morning. I think that this is a great note on Donovan. He has 1,133 rebounds through 120 career games. That's fourth all-time in Blazers history. Only to Lloyd Neal, Sidney Wicks, and the one and only Walton. Also in this game, we have two of the three guys in the NBA who have totaled 600-plus rebounds this season. Gobert, Klingon. The other is Karl-Anthony Towns. Those are the only three who have gotten to 600 rebounds. So Donovan's had a heck of a year. Tomani Kamara takes a lot of charges. And I think that Coach Splitter's done a nice job with the circumstances and whatnot with Portland. We'll see if they can put their best foot forward in a national broadcast.
I hope it's a competitive game for you. I mean, we'll see, like you said, with Denny going out against Phoenix. And hopefully Scoot Henderson can have a good game as well. I talked about him on the podcast last week after his first four games. He was highly productive. Yeah. Well, only 7 for 25 in the two games since a loss against Denver and then that win they had against the Phoenix Suns. And with the Suns, they've been in the news this week as well because Dylan Brooks is out for the next 4 to 6 weeks with a broken left hand. That's a tough loss for the Phoenix Suns, considering how important he is to their defensive identity. And this is a team that they've lost 5 of their last 8 games, a very bad February for them, 28th in offensive rating, 20th in defensive rating, 26th in net rating during the month of February. So the Phoenix Suns, a team that has been one of the best stories in basketball this year. They still are. There's a 7 seed right now in the Western Conference, but they've slid as of late, and now they've lost a key player. It's hard to feel really good about the Suns right now. I mean, granted, they had their epic double overtime win against the Magic on Saturday, but it's just hard to feel good about them this past month.
Yeah, it really is. And when you're battling through these injuries, which is something that Portland, and yes, Dame has something to do with it, but they've been hit with the Scoot Henderson and whatnot. They've had most games missed. But with Phoenix, you know, I do love the story. I think Jordan Knott has done one of the best coaching jobs in the NBA. But when you're missing multiple guys who are supposed to drive the bus, and you know, Booker can't come back here soon enough with that right hip strain. When you're missing multiple guys that are supposed to lead the way, and your offense is for a good portion of the game on Sunday night, a rough loss to Portland, is Colin Gillespie and Jamari Bouye trying to make some things happen, you're going to be in a tough spot. Now, they shot 9 of 35 from 3 in that game. They're going to be relying on that for the time being. But like Rashear Fleming, you know, a rookie out of St. Joe's, He's they're trying to stretch him out and get the most out of him. And, you know, if Ryan Dunn's playing 31 minutes, he took 9 shots in this game. Well, Kevin, in the nicest way possible, Ryan Dunn's averaging just a half points per game on the season. So the fact is, this is a team that, like, unless we see, and this is what they need right now, they need Jalen Green to kick it up. Like, if they're gonna hang in here, Jalen Green, you know, who had been out but now is back, if they're gonna get him, if they're gonna stay afloat and keep this thing on relative track, they're not gonna play as well as they have been without Brooks, because Brooks is having a tremendous year. I think that's what stinks about Phoenix, is you were finally starting to see the pieces come into play for them to be a puzzle and see if this all could work out. And maybe Green plays a more proper role. The fact is, Green has got to accelerate. They need Book back soon. Colin Gillespie, I love the story. You know, you go from undrafted to this. It's phenomenal. He's having a terrific year, but it's a lot on his shoulders right now. And they don't have enough offense. I mean, under 80 points to Portland, who wasn't, you know, and it wasn't full strength. They lost Avdija a minute into the game, and it really wasn't that competitive as it went on. So Phoenix is in.
You nailed it with Jalen Green. I mean, even that, aside from the theatrics in overtime, Jalen Green hitting the game winner, he's 6 of 26 in the game. And with Jalen Green, consistency has always been an issue for him. He's 6 of 16 in that Portland loss. He has not had a game shooting over 50% from the field since, I think, his debut earlier in the year, his first game for the Phoenix Suns. So he needs to figure things out there. That's Jalen Green's new team, his old team, now Kevin Durant's new team, the Houston Rockets. We talked very briefly earlier about the blown lead they had against the New York Knicks when they had an 18-point lead in the fourth quarter and they get absolutely smoked. Houston's offense, it's looking like they're a fatal flaw. Now, this Rockets offense, they turned over half their possessions in the clutch in that loss against the Knicks. They have a 16.3 turnover rate in clutch situations this year. That's second worst in the NBA. They have the 22nd offensive rating in clutch situations. This is increasingly becoming a fatal flaw for this team. Kevin Durant and all these other guys, Amen Thompson, Jabari Smith, everybody, they're slower decision makers, very deliberate. And I think that plays a factor in some of the turnovers this team experiences in end game situations. But ultimately, last week, I think it was, I ranked Houston, or the week prior, as the least likely team to win the finals on Jason Timp's show, Hoops Tonight, of the contenders. I think I had them ranked 10th or 11th. And that's despite them being fourth in the Western Conference right now. Like, there's plenty of good things happening there in Houston. But boy, oh boy, Fred VanVleet, the absence that they're feeling without him, they haven't been able to replicate that with Amen Thompson and Reed Shepard collectively. You could blame Udoka a little bit there, in part with the way he's used Shepard, but I also think it's partially just the fact that VanVleet is a veteran and a former champion, and those guys are just young players. But VanVleet helps solve some of those issues offensively, and with especially defensively too, the energy he brings. It's not like he's a liability on that end. I have a hard time taking them seriously as a contender, John. It just feels like this is just going to be a gap year for Houston, especially in the loaded Western Conference.
Yeah, and it just feels like with how that they're constructed, you know, it's Kevin Durant taking this possession, and then it's Alperen Şengün trying to take this possession, and their flow isn't there, and there's some evidence to back that up. Think about this here with Houston. The Rockets have scored more efficiently than the league average, which is 114.4 points per 100 possessions, in just 5 of their last 24 games. So they have been a less efficient team than the league average in 19 of the last 24. They had previously been above league average in 25 of 31. So, Kevin, that tells you in the scouting department, people have caught up to what they're trying to do with Kevin Durant and with Alperen Şengün leading the way. And, you know, Thompson and Smith, they're good pieces, but this is where there's no question about that. But this is where you've got to have guard shot, and The fact is, the question of the season coming in was, how does this team deal without Fred VanVleet? And guess what the answer is in late February? Not great. The answer is not really great. So they've got some issues here that they've got to sort out. And I don't know if they're going to be, because these things typically don't just go away in the playoffs, Kevin O'Connor.
They get worse.
They get worse. They're 20th in clutch effective field goal percentage, 29th in the league in clutch turnover rate. They're second to last in the NBA in turning over the ball in clutch time. And they've got three of their 12 guys who have committed at least 10 clutch turnovers this season. So the fact is, Kevin Durant can be a game breaker and can be outstanding. But you still got to have somebody on the perimeter that can step up consistently, not just once every three or four games. You're asked to win 4 out of 7 consistently in clutch time when a defense brings pressure and a defense says, we're not going to let you be the one that beats us. And Houston has a problem there right now.
Got some other news, big news this week, and the biggest news possible, even bigger than Team USA winning gold and Alyssa Liu winning gold and free skate and everything. It was all, everything. It's biggest news of the weekend. Killian Hayes has signed a 10-day contract with the Sacramento Kings. I mean, part of me wishes he would just disappear, but part of me is happy he's back. The Kings signed their new tank commander. People are joking. He's averaged 23 points per game, 8 assists per game in the G League, to be clear. Since last season, with even with your Cleveland Charge, your G League affiliate, since last season, shooting 37% on catch and shoot threes, 49% on mid-range pull-ups. I'm hopeful, John. I'm hopeful that he's fixed his shot and gotten over these confidence issues that he's experienced in the past. But the dude's a bust. I love how when Shams Charania reported it, he's like, he says, former number 7 pick. And it's like, yeah, you're right. My former number 1.
Yeah. You know, it's not Anthony Bennett level. It's nothing like Bennett level, but I mean, it's a sad state of affairs in Sacramento. And like, Kevin,
oh boy.
The thing about it is, it's like, they were so fun a couple years ago. You know, they were so fun. I thought they were as refreshing a story in the league not that far ago, not that long ago, within the last, 5 years? Like, it was you know, like the Beacon and all of that. And, like, it was really cool to see their fan base showed out. So, you know, did we get the reality of the situation? Yeah, but, you know, signing Hayes to a 10-day, it's certain. I mean, the elephant's in the room there of what's going on in Sacktown.
It's sad. It's very sad in Sacramento. But I hope Killian Hayes. I hope he looks okay. Okay, that's what I'm asking for. I hope he looks okay. I hope he looks like an NBA player.
I hope he does too. I hope he does too. I know I really do. I hope he does too. You know,
John. I wish more than you do. I'll tell you that. I wish very badly that Killian Hayes becomes a solid rotation player, a winning player. I hope for it. I still think there's something there. I haven't given up entirely. I just
Here's the thing. There's a wide open doorway. There's a wide open doorway to carve something out. I mean, you're gonna get minutes. You're gonna get shots. You're gonna get usage. When I look at those Western Conference standings, you put those Western Conference standings, if you don't mind, up again, because you got my mind thinking Sacramento there. Like, I am
12-46.
Yeah, 12-46. I am fascinated to see, when we're talking, you know, 1 year from now, where the team that occupies number 12, where they're sitting 1 year from now. I'm fascinated.
Oh, the Dallas Mavericks. Yeah. The Dallas Mavericks with Cooper Flagg. He's been one of the 25, 30 best players in basketball in recent weeks, but the Mavericks have the 7th best draft odds this year. They're probably going to continue to slide, I would imagine. And if they're one of the teams that moves up in the lottery, who knows? Maybe they're in the sixth spot or the seventh spot or something, or maybe something along those lines next season. Kyrie Irving comes back. If he's healthy, who knows? Maybe they're 4 or 5. Who knows with the Dallas Mavericks? It's very hard to predict, especially given this year's draft class. So let's talk draft here, John. You are a college basketball guy as well, so it's a good time to pivot here to draft class. Big weekend again for some of the top players in college basketball. Cam Boozer, just the dude doesn't have bad games. I mean, I think that's a lottery lesson with Cam Boozer. It is impossible for Cam Boozer to have a bad game. It just does not happen. It's hard to fathom how good this guy is, John.
It is hard to fathom. Also, he's tremendous defensively. I vote on the Naismith Defensive Player of the Year list, and he's been on all of them that I voted on. He is such a winning player, and he's elevated everybody around him, too. I mean, we've seen it with Isaiah Evans and Caleb Foster. He's made Duke had real backcourt questions in their preseason, and I just think that Cam has been able to say, you know, I know how to make those types of things, you know, better. This guy, he has balance and physicality at a level that's really special and that's not getting talked about enough. Is he this unreal, springy, like AJ DeBonta style? Okay, no. You know, does he show us the shades of that when Darren Peterson's been on the floor, DP has shown? No, Kevin. But you cannot question the winning ability. Everywhere that he has gone, everywhere, from grade school to high school to EYBL to these ranks. On Saturday, the majority of people had Michigan winning. It was going to be Michigan versus the field. Well, Duke exposed Michigan's offense. They showed some flaws in Michigan's offense. Duke's defense may be the best in the country, if not the second best. And that's because Cameron Boozer. Like, you think about Duke and this game. They beat Michigan on Saturday, and they shot 6 of 19 from the floor, from 3. 6 of 19 from 3. If I would have said that to you pregame, if I would have said that to the casual fan, they would have said, how much did Michigan win by? You know why? It's because Duke out-rebounded Michigan by 13. Cam Boozer led the team with 10 rebounds. And Nick Amenia had a terrific game, and you give him a lot of credit off the bench. He gave them 9 rebounds as well. But, you know, half their rebounds came from him and Boozer. The physicality of Duke is why they can win it all. Cam Boozer is that tone setter night in and night out. And he deserves consideration. I'm not saying he's going to be, but he deserves consideration to not just be the third or fourth pick in the draft. That if the right fit's there, he could be second on draft night.
Could be number one. It depends on who lands number one. And ultimately, I think you mentioned that Duke defense. I also just want to give some love to Patrick Ngamba. I mean, the dude's awesome as well. Their other big guy. He had a possession, and he's not just a shot-blocking center either. He had a possession late in the first half. I forget who he was defending. I think it was one of Michigan's backup guards, if I remember correctly. And he was on a switch on the perimeter. And the guard drove to the right side of the wing and tried to cross him over. And Ngamba just stuck his right arm out there like a snake out of the grass and just swatted at the ball, poked it away on a switch. And it's like, oh, my God, this guy's 7 feet, 250, something along those lines once he's in the NBA. And this guy's moving his feet, sliding on the perimeter, showing quick hands. Duke, I mean, their roster – Boozer, Ngamba, Star, Evans, they get a bunch of guys on this team, Caden Boozer as well, that at someday are going to get big opportunities in the NBA. And with Boozer specifically, I mean, you're right. Like, offensively, people talk about him, but defensively, dude's a winning player as well. But it is going to be contested for number one. You know, Darren Peterson, we talked about his situation last week. Not much has changed there. But with AJ DeBonta, I feel like right now the case is strong for AJ to go number one. It is increasingly strong for AJ to be the number one pick in the NBA draft, given the stretch that he's on right now. His last six games, 29, 10, and 9, 35 points, 20 points, 8 assists, 36, 7, and 5, 28, 5, and 4, 36, 7, and 4. The dude's on an absolute heater. He's shooting the jumper better than he has all season long. And that's only more opening up his ability to just gallop to the basket with those long strides, that herky-jerky, hard to know what direction he's going to go style of play. I mean, the dude at 6'9", I've never seen a guy with his style of driving to the basket. It's just so exciting to watch. But then now he's doing more on top of that. He's rebounding more than ever. He's playing harder on defense. He had that quote after the big win against Iowa State: "If I got to play 40 minutes, I'll play 40 minutes." I mean, I feel like he's answering the call that this team needs, and he's coming through in a big way. I'm beyond impressed by Brockton's own AJ DiBonsa.
And BYU loses Richie Saunders to a brutal injury. He's an All-American caliber player. And AJ shows them, hey, we still have a chance to do something special because, you know what, I can drive this team. That's a leader. That means something to the culture in your locker room. And those are things that scouts and evaluators love to see. His balance, his strength, his ability to shift directions quickly. We're watching something truly special right now from this young man. And you think about the top of this draft class. This is why the top of this draft class is historic. It is historic. Here's every freshman to average 22, 6, and 4 on 62% true shooting in the last 25 years. AJ DiBonsa, Cameron Boozer. That's the end of the list. Wow. So you cannot argue with what they are doing from an efficiency and from a... I'm just so impressed by the way that they handle this level, a level that Kevin, the top of the country, has been stronger in college basketball. We have never seen this much scoring. You know, you've seen it in some of these games. Like, the game quality is as high as it's ever been this time of year, which is great for the sport, and I think it's excellent for the sport of basketball in general. It's almost as if, like, the trend of shot making and perimeter game and skills, all that training that we saw, you know, over the last 12 years in the NBA evolved. Like, the college game almost had to go through a cycle out where they were trying to get to that level, and now it's sort of reached that level again. AJ really is a spectacular prospect because the guy has the intangibles. The guy's got the frame. He's got the wingspan. He's got the burst, and he's become a better shot maker and a better shooter and a better facilitator. His decision-making to me on Saturday against Iowa State was the best I've ever seen.
He was slinging the ball around the floor, making perfect reads. It felt like he was manipulating the defense as well. And like you mentioned, the Richie Saunders torn ACL season injury. What a blow, man. I mean, for him, 4 years at BYU, gave all his blood, sweat, and tears to that college. And then for his playing career to end like this at BYU is just heartbreaking. And then for the Cougars as well, for a team that does have national championship hopes, to lose him, you're going to see defenses shrink the floor for Wright and DiBonsa and try to make it hard for them to get into the paint. But you get at least feel encouraged that this team could maybe make a deep run with AJ playing at the level he is as of late. I mean, the dude's just been extraordinary. I think I'm leaning towards having him number one on my board once I end up releasing my draft guide at some point over this next month. But AJ's been fantastic. Who's a weekly riser on your board, John? A guy that maybe, like, he's not AJ or not Darren Peterson, one of these guys that we don't talk about enough. Who do you got?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go with Braylon Mullins of Connecticut. And he's dealt with some injury issues this season. But I'll tell you what, I really love his shot-making ability, and I love his poise. And he's fit right in at UConn. He's got a knack for making the right timely play and making some big, big boy shots along the way. But Braylon, this past week, like, you know, they lost to Creighton, but he was their best player for a good portion of the game. He had 25 points in that one, follows it up, you know, a more moderate performance against Villanova. But we have seen in big moments, a win at Providence back in January where he hit three or four mammoth shots. Kevin,
that Providence game was Klay Thompson-esque, the way he was moving off ball. It was unbelievable. He could, like, the defense knew what was coming and they still couldn't stop him. That's what I mean when I say Klay Thompson-esque.
Yeah, he was absolutely tremendous in that game and really, really showed, you know, his upside and his potential to come off ball screens and drill it from downtown. So I like Braylon a lot. The defensive end of the floor is the biggest thing that evaluators are going to be zoning in on when they're looking at where his fit's going to be. But as you know, in a shot-making league like the NBA, there is a place for a Braylon Mullins to come in and be in a support role. Well, he is my riser. I am just going to put respect on a couple of names in this class. Like, folks, when you're talking about the very best freshman, you now need to be talking about Darius Acuff of Arkansas. He is one of them. He has been spectacular. He had a close to 50-point game last week. I really am intrigued with him. And then a guy that's a little bit off the road in terms of not top 10, but I'm just giving this to you for hoops knowledge, people that want to sound smarter by the water cooler. Watch Joshua Jefferson on the first-round draft boards. He's at Iowa State. Kevin, he does everything correctly. Like, is he DeBonsa upside? No. 10 pick? Probably not. But I think that he's going to be an interesting prospect to monitor.
Yeah, I mean, that those are some good names there. I think Mykel Brown, another one as well, out of Louisville. Just the way he's performed as of late. He had a back injury that's limited him all year long. But the 45-point game he had, then he followed it up with 29 and then 29 again. And, you know, Georgia Tech, he only had 19. But, I mean, the dude, when his shot is falling, just like there's nothing you can do about that dude. So there's just a lot of guys in this year's draft class. Wogler from Illinois. You can end up with a sixth or seventh pick in this year's draft and be like, hey, we haven't even mentioned Caleb Wilson. We didn't mention that name. What if Nate Emmett turns out into what people thought he would be? That's like, we just did less than like 9-10 guys, right?
Kingston
would ordinarily. Yeah, Fleming's this one.
It's so good. It's so
never good. Ending.
Hannes Steinbach at Washington is another guy that people need to be looking at that, you know, hasn't gotten as much attention. Tunde Yesufu at Baylor, Brayden Burries at Arizona. It is draft night.
LeBaron Filon from Alabama, another one.
draft night is going to be like the lead up to the draft night. But you know what? It's all going to start in March. We are in for a potentially all-time NCAA tournament because, Kevin, when you combine the one-game playoffs with this crop of NBA-ready talent, the interest goes up.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm very, 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 very excited. I've been covering the draft every week all season. We've done this draft class segment, and definitely going to have you on again before the draft, John, and talk more about these prospects and more about the NBA as well. Dude, I'm so fired up for you tomorrow night. I can't say I'm going to be up late on the East Coast watching Minnesota-Portland live, but I will 100% be watching it the following morning to listen to your call. My bedtime's early, John. I watch games in the morning. That's what I do. I've been going to bed at 10 p.m. every night.
I look forward to hearing from you. We've been talking basketball for a long time, and I'm humbled to get the call to do it, and I'm looking forward to being at the moment. On Tuesday night. Can't wait.
I mean, it's been good getting to know you over the years, John, ever since I think we met at Summer League. It's some restaurant in Old Vegas, I remember, correctly.
Yeah. Our guy, Matt Terhali. Shout out to Matt Terhali.
Yes.
An Oregon State Beaver who will also be around in Portland. Make that much
awesome. Great. Awesome. He'll be there with you too. That's great. John, congrats, man. Fired up for you. And looking forward to talking basketball with you again, whether it's over here or over text message. Thanks for joining me today, man.
Love the KOC show. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again to John Fanta. We have a special third episode this week coming out on Wednesday with an interview. I'm not going to spoil it, but I am very, very much looking forward to that interview dropping on Wednesday. Thank you to Brad and the team for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music. And I hope you have a good week. Talk to you on Wednesday and then again on Thursday. Have a good one, everybody.